David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science stories. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about whether running shoes are the fountain of youth, how water striders stay afloat, and finally, the genetics of body odor.
All right, well, let's start with running shoes as the fountain of youth. Something about the health benefits of running?
Well, Rob, we all know that running is a good exercise in terms of maintaining health. But when the running craze started in the 1970s in the United States and elsewhere, some doctors were concerned that older people that started running were doing damage to their body, namely damage to their joints and perhaps giving themselves other types of injuries that they wouldn't get if they weren't running. But a scientist at Stanford University felt the opposite. He felt that no matter what age you started running, and especially if you started running older, the pros far outweighed the cons. So what he did was he and some of his colleagues started way back in 1984 tracking over 500 runners over the age of 50. And they've been following them for over 20 years now. And every year they would give them a questionnaire about how well they were performing in life, you know, how what their ease of certain life tasks were, like even things like doing the laundry and putting on clothes, and also monitoring their health. What kind of health were they in? What kind of diseases were they getting? Were they dying? Things like that.
With the idea of comparing them against some control group.
Right. They compared them against a control group of non-runners.
Who presumably were also healthy, just not running.
Right. Well, the concern with a study like this is always cause and effect. Do people start running because they're healthier to begin with, and therefore you might misconclude that runners just tend to be healthier, or are people healthier because they run? And so to try to control for that, the researchers looked at a control group of people who were generally in the same type of shape as the runners were, they just weren't runners. And what they found was, first of all, not very surprising that the runners tended to be in better shape than the non-runners. But what was surprising was the amount of difference they saw in the types of diseases and mortality among the runners compared to the non-runners. For instance, 19 years into the study, 34% of the non-running group had died compared to only 15% of the running group. And what's more, only about 7% of the runners had infections and neurological diseases and diseases like cancer, whereas 19% of the non-runners had those sorts of problems.
And that difference is statistically significant?
That difference is statistically significant. And what was also a really neat finding is the researchers found that even people who only ran regularly for about a month during their lives, so they took up running, they did it for a little while, but then they gave it up, even they showed some benefits of running. Now, the benefits weren't as great as the people that were running full-time, but even just a little bit of running seems to have a positive effect on long-term health.
Have researchers figured out what it is exactly about running that's actually helping people live longer?
No, it's a really interesting question. And obviously, that's the next step in the study to figure out. Now that we know that running does have these dramatic effects on health, the question is, how is it doing it?
Well, from running for your health to walking on water, what's new about water striders? These are the little bugs that skitter around on the tops of lakes and other calm water surfaces.
Right, exactly. These are these neat little insects that skim across the top of water. And scientists have been trying to figure out for a long time, how do these guys stay above the water? Why don't they sink? And they know it has something to do with a property called surface tension. The more you can sort of disperse your mass over a larger area, the less you're likely to sink in the water because you're distributing that mass and it's not putting as much sort of strain on the top of the water. But the water striders have these very specific length of legs. And researchers are wondering, what is it about that length? Is there a magic number for how long those legs are that is just precisely optimized for keeping these guys on top of the water? And so they did a bunch of mathematical calculations. And what they ended up with was sort of comparing the water strider's legs to a pool noodle.
These are the little floaty.
Right. These are these like long styrofoam kind of bars that kids hang on to in the pools and sometimes adults hang on to too and just help them stay afloat. And so if you think of a water strider's leg as a pool noodle, you can imagine that the longer the noodle gets or the longer the leg gets, you start to get some bending when it comes in contact with the water. And the shorter the leg is or the shorter the noodle is, the stiffer it is. And what the researchers found was that if the noodle or the leg is too short, it's going to break the surface tension of the water because too much mass is being concentrated in too small of an area. But if the noodle is too long, it starts to bend or the leg starts to bend and it creates too much drag on the water. And that causes the insect difficulty staying afloat. So when they looked at the legs of this insect, they found that the length of the leg was almost exactly the maximum length it would need to be to maximally support the insect without causing drag. So it seems that over the millions of years that these insects have been evolving, these legs have grown to this optimal length to keep them on top of the water without having too much drag and without making them sink.
The selective pressure is sort of driving that optimization then.
Exactly.
How are researchers hoping to apply this knowledge?
Well, it's kind of a neat finding just to figure out something like this. But, you know, researchers are developing robots and other things that can skim the surface of water. So the more they can learn about how it happens in nature, the more they can apply it to future technology.
Well, from the physics of surface tension to the genetics of body odor, I really would have thought this would have been more about the chemistry of sweat.
Well, it kind of is. If you think about body odor comes from a combination of two things, the sweat that we excrete out our pores and also the bacteria that live in places like our armpits. And this sweat that we excrete has at least 24 types of a compound known as carboxylic acid. And these acids somehow react with the bacteria and create the stink that you might have after a workout. But it's not just these bad smells we are concerned about when we talk about body odor. We're also talking about potential impact on mate choice. Researchers have shown that body odor in mice helps males and females select the appropriate mate. And there's been some evidence in humans that a similar process takes place. So
the genetics is affecting the chemistry.
Well, the idea is the genetics is affecting the chemistry because you have different people who have different body odors. So there must be a genetic component, but how do you go about measuring it? Well, in this study, researchers used a classic system, and that was to go to identical twins. And genetic twins share all the same DNA, so their genetics is pretty much the same. And they wanted to see, do genetic twins manufacture the same kind of body odor chemicals because they have the same genes? And they recruited, for this study, they recruited 12 pairs of identical twins, 7 sets of sisters, and 5 sets of brothers. And they put cotton pads under their armpits and had them exercise for about an hour. And then after that, they took the pads and they did some chemical analysis to figure out exactly which types of carboxylic acids were being produced by which people. And lo and behold, as they expected, the carboxylic acids produced by each twin was very similar to that of the other twin. And when they compared the twins to other people, they noticed very different carboxylic acid patterns. So this is really the strongest evidence yet that these odors that we produce are genetically determined. Our genes determine how we smell.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about a hidden cholera epidemic, about a spooky speed limit. And this is the speed limit that governs how photons communicate with each other over large distances. And it has to do with some bizarre properties of quantum mechanics. And finally, we're looking into a story about how contraceptive pills may change how attracted some women are to men. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.